Hi, I'm John Coe, and welcome to Icons of DC Area Real Estate, a one-on-one interview show highlighting the backgrounds and career trajectory of leading luminaries in the Washington, D.C. area real estate market. The purpose of the show is to highlight their backgrounds and their experiences and some interesting stories about their current business as well as their past, and to cite some things that you might take away, both from an educational standpoint as well as lessons learned in the industry, and some amusing and sometimes interesting background stories. So I'm hoping you will enjoy the show. Before I introduce my guest, I'd like to share that both this podcast and the community I started in 2021 called The Iconic Journey in CRE is now part of a new nonprofit organization with that same name. The new company will offer opportunities for sponsorship to grow the community both in membership and in programs. It also allows you as listeners to show your appreciation for this podcast, which has delivered episodes twice monthly since August 2019, with a charitable contribution. Transitioning the community and podcast into the nonprofit organization is underway. The community, which is open to commercial real estate professionals between the ages of 25 and 40 years old, is currently up to 65 members and growing. If you would like to learn more about either joining the community or contributing to the podcast, please reach out directly to me at john@coenterprises.com. Separately, my private company, Coenterprises, now will focus only on advisory work for early stage real estate firms and career counseling. If you have interest in learning more about its services, please review my website at coenterprises.com. Thank you for listening.
Hi, this is John Coe, and welcome to another episode of Icons of DC Area Real Estate. This is a special episode where I've brought together a panel of five prior icons for a live session at the law firm of Seyfarth Shaw in downtown Washington, with 30, roughly, members of the Iconic Journey in CRE in a very intimate, private session to talk about the 2025 market coming forward in the Washington, D.C. area, as well as advice for young people. The five panelists are Bob Murphy of MRP Realty, Lacey Rice of FCP, Toby Bizzuto of Bizzuto Group, Vicki Davis of Urban Atlantic, and Henry Fonville of the Rappaport Company. My two member speakers who spoke right up front are Kevin Dean of Rockbridge Investments and Colin Thomas of Thomas Development, both of whom have been members of the community for 3 years plus and have been very active interacting with other members and growing their businesses and having significant success, and the community being a big part of that success. So really the purpose of this was to introduce members to the opportunities that the icons discuss, as well as to be able to network and meet each other. And of course, my mission is to grow this community to a reasonable number, probably not too large, but large enough so that people have a wide variety of connections that they can make and learn how to adapt to this very fast-moving industry that we're in, commercial real estate today. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging panel discussion, led off again by Kevin Dean and Colin Thomas, and then each of the panelists talk first about the market projections as well as we go in then into the advice for leaders. So without further ado, here is the panel.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining. Thank you for joining today. Welcome on this crisp
and chilly morning. It's heartwarming to see you guys here. I really appreciate it. Thank you for braving the cold and joining us today. So today what we're going to do is we're going to start with two member brief discussions about their experiences with the iconic journey in CRA. And then after that, we'll start our panel discussion after that. So Kevin Dean, you want to step to the mic, and then Colin, you can come after that.
Thank you. Kevin. Morning, everybody. How we doing? So for those of you I have not met, my name is Kevin Dean, Rockbridge Investment Group. Been a part of the community, I think, since the very beginning. I may have joined a month or two late. But just wanted to briefly share kind of what the community has done for me and sort of what I've taken away from it. Going back to 2021, I was actually working at Fannie Mae and was just jumping from Fannie Mae to go full-time in the business that I had started back in 2018. It was kind of a pivotal time for me where I knew enough to be dangerous, but not really enough to be very smart. So getting into this group, I was surrounded by a bunch of peers who were doing projects way bigger than me. You know, like Chad, for example, is always working on these, you know, $100 million deals with Mill Creek and other guys where, you know, it's just, I'm trying to get these $10, $15 million deals done. And I'm talking to somebody in the room who's, you know, working on an extremely difficult challenge that I didn't even know really existed. And then on the flip side, you know, we've got individuals such as you on the panel here that have got way more experience than us. And, you know, the community allowed us to really get on site and actually walk the real estate with people who are in the business every day, who have, you know, made the mistakes, who have learned from them. And I would say the one thing that I've really taken away from being a part of this community is kind of seeing what's possible and kind of getting out of the box of, you know, doing a deal like this is impossible or building a business like this is impossible, and just seeing, you know, the icons in the DC area, you know, going from, you know, in many cases, very small kind of startup real estate company to, you know, name brand real estate company in the area. So it's just been extremely fulfilling, not only to build relationships with people in the room here, but also just to learn from individuals such as you all up here on the panel and just really kind of jump the learning curve many years just from being around you guys. So thank you. And John, thanks for having us here today.
First, I want to thank John. He's done a lot of work to put all of this together. He's brought all these great panelists here, a lot of people whose names you know, but now you can actually have an opportunity to meet them. That's one thing that his community provides, I think, is access, but access not just to panelists like this. Really, as Kevin mentioned, access to all of your peers, because John, a lot of you are hand recruited by John. A lot of you are exemplary in some form, which is why you're here. And so you can really reach out to any individual here and really gain a lot of insight. You can solve problems. You know, if you need recommendations on contractors, if you need to meet someone in the capital markets, you can get those things done through an exercise with your peers. And I think it's a close-knit group, and it does a great job of bringing specific people together who are like-minded. And it really is, I can give a couple concrete examples. I had one friend who John introduced me to, who's a member of this group. He's not here today. His name's Jacob Hamilton. He has a residential development company, but he found an apartment building listed on the single family MRIS. And we ended up closing on this apartment building. It was a fantastic deal. But he called me because we were in this group together and we had chatted a bunch, and he was interested in doing apartments. So, and I made him a partner in the deal, and that worked out great. You know, I can call Kevin if I need some fundraising advice. He's been banging the phones for years, so I get to hear, learn of problems before they arise from me and Kevin. But I really do think it's a great group. Thank you all for being a part of it. It's been helpful for me, and always feel free to reach out. And also a big thank you to John for putting it all together. Thank you.
All right, so we're here to now have a little panel to conversation. We're going to have two topics today we're going to talk about. First is kind of a forecast of the 2025 real estate market here in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm going to ask five questions of the panelists here in general to start with. And then the second part of it is going to be advice for young people, for young professionals. And I'm going to ask each panelist to take a topic and kind of lead a conversation there, looking for interaction from all of you. to respond, any questions you have along the way, et cetera. So there it is. So I'm going to sit down and join the panel here. I'll just go ahead and say the first question is, a second. What trends of development do you anticipate will dominate the DC area in the real estate market in 2025? So I'm going to leave that. I'm going to open that up for discussion and let the panelists respond.
Go to order, I guess. I mean, for me, there's probably the biggest thing, screaming in your face is a stressed office. And I don't mean keeping his office, but what do you do with these buildings you're going to tear down and what happens there? And, you know, some cases, conversion, some cases, you know, you renovate it and you keep it as an office. In some cases, you know, straight up tear down. So there's a lot of it out there. And that's probably, we have more than, you know, we have a large office market relative to the rest of the supply, you know, if you look at our product type. So I think this market probably more than a lot of other markets around the country has to process that.
I think for us, the headwinds of demographics and employment are big drivers because we invest in apartments and we look across the country for the most prosperous markets over the next 5 to 7 years. And DC has had its challenges with regulation in Montgomery County, Prince George's County, and the district that have made it more difficult to be an institutional apartment owner. There's a lot of bluster going on about downsizing the federal government. It's difficult to determine at this point if that's going to be good or bad for jobs and economics here. So we're keeping an eye on that. The back office dynamic here has been, I think, the worst in the world. Worse than the U.S., and the U.S. is behind everybody else and going back to office. So that may get a lot better if these guys really do carry a baseball bat and force people to go back to work. And those people don't say, "How with you, I'm going into retirement." So it'll be interesting to watch that. The city seems to be on the right track. Thanks to people like Bob, Law and Order, and all those things that are important for commerce seem to be moving in the right direction. How quickly and how far they'll go are things that we're watching. That really drives a ton of aversion to institutional investors. I think one thing that's interesting that's happened in our careers is it's a lot easier to move from market to market today than it was 30 years ago because there's so much good information available just like that. So being an insider is not significant a barrier to entry, in my opinion. And it, similarly, institutional capital can move very quickly as well. So if the district has a TOPA tax that nobody else has and really impacts growth, money just goes like that to some other city. And conversely, it can come back very quickly too. So it'd be interesting to see how that works.
The city, or if you can't pay, or if people cannot pay their rent or self-certify their income. Same thing, bad policy.
Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting in this cycle, I think, is people are much more inclined to give the keys back to banks and other institutions. Mm-hmm. In our day, they go through long workouts, your reputation is everything. You didn't do that. So money, everything moves a lot faster today. And a good decision or a bad decision can really change that, particularly at the governmental level. So those are some things.
Good morning. My answer is more multifamily centric. That's what I do. And in the multifamily sector, there have not been a lot of transactions, a lot of trades of buildings selling because of obvious reasons. If you sell now, you're selling it, at least in theory, at some sort of discount to what maybe only what you think you should have gotten. Maybe this is the new pricing. But the cost of capital is so expensive that it's encumbering the price of the assets. So what I think is going to happen both in a macro U.S. sense and micro in D.C. is that you're going to see a lot of dispositions or acquisitions, put another way, in D.C. of multifamily. And I'm using D.C. as in the broader MSA. But an interesting dynamic is exactly the one Lacey said, which is capital can flow wherever it wants to go. And capital will flow to a place with the least amount of friction, both on new developments and on acquisition. So if we may sell a building or we're contemplating selling a building and in DC, but whoever buys it has to suffer through this protracted TOPA process before things settle out. And during that time, anything can happen. Just macro variables can come in versus another place where you buy and the next morning you own it. So if you're a capital provider, why waste your time? So that will be interesting to see what cap rates end up being in DC, MSA, relative to other regions. On a positive note, some of us read an article yesterday that there were some good sales, or at least a very good multifamily sale in Clarendon. And that was a nice green shoot of, so I think money will go to Northern Virginia versus DC. More of a micro comment. But anyway, interesting year. And until the market establishes what the heck cap rates even are, I don't think development starts to happen till much further, because how do you price risk if you don't know what an exit cap is? And right now, few trades don't make a cap rate environment. So we'll see. Yeah.
Good morning. We've been sort of chatting about this issue. I want to start my response similar to some of the others and say, I think it starts with demographics. Baby boomers, right? And probably all your parents are, and millennials out there. And I think that people in my age bracket are retiring, some of them, typically between 65 and 80 people are retiring, so a little bit later than it used to be. So I think we're seeing that. I'm the last year of the baby boom, biggest year. And I think that people have been talking about the silver tsunami for decades now, but I think it's here. And so we have people who are trapped in enormous homes out in the world at very low interest rates or paid off or whatever, and trying to figure out what to do next. So I think that's something. And that might include migration southward, by the way, or to warmer climes. I have kids who are probably a tiny bit younger than you, late 20s, early 30s, and they have more weddings this year amongst their friends than ever before. I think they're clocking in at 7 or 8 weddings, which they're all the best men. And you're like, oh my God. And they're all destination weddings. Yeah. Who knew? So I'd like to see a show of hands and see if that's true for you guys and your cohort. Who's got weddings this year?
Yeah.
Who's got more than 3? Okie dokes. I would like to ask you, how many of you guys are either married or in relationships? Aha. How many of you guys have babies or babies on the way? I feel a little, well, what is this?
Not sure. That's enough. Don't ask. It's too early. Way too early.
How many of you own your own home? Aha. Well, I think there are people who are following you to own your own home. So I think home ownership. How many own your own home in D.C.? In the city? How many own outside the city? So I think less people are buying in the city. I think you're going for a larger home in the burbs. And my guess is that that's a trend that will continue. Thanks for playing with
me. Yeah, that's good. That's good. You got everybody excited. So at Rappaport, we do retail investment, you know, and at landlord advisory. So we have kind of a unique lens that I do business with everybody at the table. On the suburban side, suburban shoppers are super strong. You know, all the people that have left town, not working from home, are increasing the sales in the suburban shops. That being said, there's no supply. No new shops are being built. And occupancies get super high, and rents are going to are getting high, so much so that you're going to price some people off. So suburban shops are going to be great. On the urban side, either in a residential building or an office building in Washington, D.C., we're seeing consolidation. Some people are getting stronger in the nodes like 7th and 10 or, you know, wherever there's a lot of traffic. It used to be that we'd put retail on the first floor of every building downtown. It'd be something. And now you just can't do that. There's not enough demand, especially when you don't know if there's going to be, you know, how many days a week you can actually support a loan. So we're going to see those nodes getting stronger. You know, I'd love to see the 8th Street redevelopment happen and that be a retail corridor. So there's going to be a ton of opportunity for all of us here in the room. The only question is, how long does it take for these buildings to change uses, go to residential, go to trophy office? Everybody probably saw the BXP buying Metro Center yesterday. You know, for the last, I think, 2-3 years, people were trying to reuse the existing building to convert that residential, and nobody can make a pencil. Now BXP is going to come in and demo it. You know, it's pretty dramatic. It means somebody lost a lot of money. Well, Heinz lost a lot of money, and the lender lost a lot of money. Now Heinz has got to build a really expensive building. So in my mind, we're going to be very busy, all of us in this room, over the next 10, 20 years, remaking D.C.
As a follow-up,
yeah.
I mean, say there's supply and demand. Why wouldn't developers look at the sites?
You know, the construction costs, John, are just so out of whack right now. And the and then the interest rates, you know, nobody's going to invest for quarter half with return. And the rates are already so high. So we have a piece of property, you know, and right beside Whole Foods development in Virginia that we're actively negotiating on. But, you know, you missed a little neighborhood center, we're going to have to get $60 rents. And, you know, $60 rents, lease up takes a long time. You know, you're not going to open it 100% leased. So if you have a 50% lease up, you know, you're going to drag out and your IRR is going to go, I hate to see where it's going to go. So the other thing, just that you asked that question, is we need to update our retail shopping centers in the zone. You know, a lot of the centers look the same way they did 40 years ago. And there are a ton of improvements in the retail, the sides and interiors that need to happen. One more piece of information is a bunch of centers are selling, as Debbie was saying, where, you know, where are the prices going? You've got interest rates at 5.5-6%. Who can afford to buy a Wegmans anchored shopping center, $100 million, you know, if it's selling for a 6 cap? What we've seen recently, things that we're actively bidding on for our advisory, investment advisory clients, is just somebody will come in and just take it. You know, they've got 1031 money. It's a REIT. It's a high net worth individual who believes in the future. They've got no cost of capital. They're buying all cash. And they just go, okay, we'll take it. And we can't compete with that. We don't want to compete. I don't like anybody at the table. We're heading for that. So you almost have two different spectrums going on at the same time. But the center I'm talking about was sold by JLL, Stonehenge, down in Richmond. It wasn't even the, you know, Metro DC. I'm on a Richmond asset. So it's amazing what happened.
So when rents get to $60 a foot, you start to see development.
You know, John, I don't think, given the value of our land and interest rates and those rents, the risk is still too high. So, in answer to your question, I'm not going out to look and buy
sites.
But one last piece about retail. Sorry to dominate here for a minute. The last 15 years, everybody's been talking about big box and internet and how retail is going to get killed. We haven't built any new big boxes. Those big box rents went from roughly $15 a square foot triple net down to around 10. And even at the 10, the landlord had to do all the work for like any TJX concept. So the net effect of rent was probably $2. You had to do it because you had to throw tenancy. And they forced you into build to suit. Well, those rents now, because of no new boxes, are finally going some over $20 a foot. So that's a huge move. If there's any place where there's like, you know, happiness in the retail industry, it's with the big box rents.
Bob, you just bought the Oliver Gallery Place. Huge investment there. Talk about that investment.
I mean, I think Lacey kind of alluded to it. You know, we all know during COVID, things got pretty rough here, and there were some bad decisions, a lot of self-inflicted wounds. Your government, frankly, on a policy. And so, you know, the area, even though it's, you know, there's really no low-income housing at all around Gallery Place, and you have to go above Convention Center and the other side of 395. You know, and so the problem is that there's 25,000 workers, 3,000 residents, 3,500 residents, just, you know, kind of, no one's going to work, so no one's there, and there's all kinds of metro, and there's, and it just was pretty vacant. So that crime, it's all petty crime primarily, really picked up in that area. And now if you're going to a game last year, you know, a concert, you know, people were nervous, you know, about walking down 7th Street between H and that corner was pretty rough. But I knew just, I mean, I've done a lot of deals in this area. I mean, I was part of the process post, you know, post mid-90s on about I did like maybe 5 or 6 buildings in that area and bought land and stuff. So, you know, I know what it costs to build. I know all history of land and my takeaway with Gallery Place. And I did not know they were staying. I thought they were going. In fact, I was trying to help them stay, but, you know, through some lobbying efforts, but I thought it was a done deal. But I did know that if you gave me 2 acres of land at 7th and H, you gave me $40 million and you said build 700 parking spaces, I couldn't do it. So, you know, I kind of bought a parking garage with an 8-year-old. And then we got lucky. So. But fundamentally, though, I knew my market. I knew my area. I knew what cost to build. You know, I know that the White House is 7 blocks that way. Capitol 7 blocks that way. Mall's 4 blocks that way. I just knew you weren't going to go wrong. So. And we got lucky. So there you go. Sometimes that happens. I think it was rates for me. It's always bad, you know. I mean, rates drive everything. The reason no one's building any multifamily right now, you know, there's issues with the District of Maryland, but in Virginia, for example, they're starting to go now because rates have not come in enough, and you know, people feel good enough, I think, about it that you know, you can maybe start a couple, but we're still not where we need to be. I mean, rates need to come in another 50+ basis points.
Mm-hmm. Or revenue's gonna grow enough to justify the cost.
I think the rents get pretty high right now. It's just like,
I think that's the underlying theme that I'm trying to impress upon my folks is. Construction, we've with the construction costs over the last 40 years. When they make these quantum moves up, they don't come back down. They level, and there's a decent amount of margin in construction costs. So what you're seeing now with the handful of starts that you're starting to see across the country is contractors are operating effectively a 0% margin so that they can keep their subs employed and keep their people in business because they know in 12 to 24 months it's going to change and they want to be on the front end of it. So I think across all sectors, retail is another great example. I think offices are going to see it. There's going to be real inflation adjusted, real rent growth that is going to justify the environment. I think is not going to have 2% inflation. Something above that, not going to have interest rates that much lower than they are today. But we were all around when making money when rates were 7, 8, 9, 10%. And you guys, So the one point I'd like to make to you, all of you who are much younger than we are, is look at all these fears as opportunities, not as reasons not to do it, but reasons to do it, because everybody else, particularly us old folks, it's chicken. You've got your little nest egg now. You're 40 or 50 and you don't want to blow it. So I'm not going to go start speculating on Class A apartments in D.C. when I don't know where to focus.
That's true. That you go from wealth creation to wealth preservation.
Yeah. So, but it's for folks like you to say, hey, you know, this TOPA thing is unsustainable. They're going to get rid of it. I'm going to make a bet. I can buy these Class A properties at 60 basis points better yield than any other market in the country. Because as soon as they get rid of TOPA, the differential is going to collapse, and I'm going to be a hero. And I'm going to, in 20 years, be sitting on a panel.
Yeah,
people like that.
I mean, TOPA has to change. Because, you know, listen, the way I look at it is you want more affordable housing. Right? How do you get more affordable housing? Well, you don't get it by having rent control, you don't get it by having TOPA, you don't get it by having ERAP, you don't get it by letting people self-certified for income. You get it by, you know, you go to if you go to Arlington County, it's 2%, 2 or 3% vacancy, right? Or you know, delinquency. Here, we were getting 20, 30%. Crazy. So, but the point being that you make all those policy decisions and you get less housing, not more housing, and you're screwing over your community.
No, it doesn't work at all. And I think the city's starting to see that. And we all remember when in the 70s and 80s, this neighborhood really, really not close. And that seems like a long, long time ago. But in your career, that's a 20-year period is the period you want to bet on.
Yeah.
And if you would have made a bet on D.C. in 1985, you would have killed it.
And I mean, guys, like, if you look at this area, I mean, you know, the Verizon Center back there, MCI Center, delivered in like late 97. But again, we built Market Square on 7th and H, or 7th Pennsylvania. You go 2 blocks north of there, you know, you weren't parking your car there and coming back and finding it, man. It was really rough. I remember when Jamal was doing, you know, across from what's now Gallery Place, you know, his Brownson, Road Brownson's. It was all burnt out back in like 97, 98, driving past it. I'm like, wow, this guy's pretty bold. And then 5 years later, I'm building a office building went to a law firm right behind her. So the things change pretty quickly. Once a good policy, I think Lacey's comments, once a good policy happens, everybody knows that DC is the capital of the most powerful country in the world, militarily and economically. Right? So it has a purpose. It's just bad policy. I mean, for example, Henry could talk to food deserts. You want to get rid of food deserts? Everybody in Ward 7, Ward 8 eats, right? They go to other wards to buy because, you know, there's no housing there. There's no retail there. Why isn't there retail there? Because they get robbed blind. So they take care of the 5%, 2, 5, 3, you know, whatever it is, percent that steals shit, and they screw over the 95%. Easy to fix. Just, you know, it's good for everybody. Like, you need to have, people need boundaries. Like, don't go in there and steal shit. Sorry. Pet peeve.
Well, Henry's company's made investments.
Yeah, huge.
Talk about those investments.
Well, it does not give me pleasure to talk about that, but it is a hot topic. So I've been in D.C. over 40 years. When I lived in Foggy Bottom, my grocery store was a Safeway about 15,000 square feet over the border. It was pathetic, you know. And we've been hearing about that all our careers. And investments have been made. There've been an amazing amount of grocery stores that have opened in Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, as Bob said, there's some bad actors who go in with a grocery cart and just load it up with laundry detergent because it's easily sellable on the market. They just roll out with, you know, 20 bottles of laundry detergent down the street and they can set it. It's, you know, it's easy to sell. And some of the grocery stores are doing $40, $50 million in volume, which is an amazing volume. In a suburban grocery store. Some of these grocery stores are doing that volume and losing money. So without going through the names of the individual stores, I can tell you there's a lot of people looking at closing their stores based upon the profitability. So it is really sad that Rappaport and a lot of other good investors have built grocery stores taking care of what they used to call the food desert. And a lot of them are on the bubble. And to add to that in the food desert for the restaurants, you know, east of the river, there are only a couple, like two, I think, sit-down full-service restaurants. And that's a shame. We've been killing ourselves to try to do another six or seven. We have a lot of QSRs east of the river, but trying to do full-service restaurants. And it's really hard. And that's even with the food access grant from the district. The food access grant, the way it's written, is if you get $1 million, you get, you know, a third of it up front, a third of it when you open, and a third a year after you're open. And the reason why they've done that is because they don't want people just to open up and close. But the reality is most people can't finance that third. That means you'd have to go to a bank to get that final third. Once you open, to, you know, to stay in an opening for a while. So the way they wrote it has made it so difficult, you can't use it. I'm sure you guys have already seen what's going on with the tax. They're trying to get people doing the conversions. Same thing. There's so many restrictions based on that tax for 10 years that you get if you go to residential. I'm sure Toby's looking at it. Vicky's looking at it going, how did I get that help from you? I'm going to have to do this over here.
Speaking of urban development, could you talk about a little bit about your experience in the
region? So, I have a very wise partner in Wallace who says, you know, the pendulum swings this way and then back in the other direction. And during COVID, we had a pretty terrible swing. And what happened is that I'm just going to generalize and say the city swung pretty liberal and there was no eviction court and there was no law enforcement. Those are extremes. There was some. And what it did is it changed values a bit. And so what's being experienced in Southeast is being experienced throughout the city. If people know they're not going to be prosecuted, then they're going to do stuff. I've heard of things personally from the security guards at the stores at Whole Foods, because we have a band of gypsies who comes to shop with us, and we're not allowed to touch them. They go in, they fill the cart, and they leave. Snatch and grab at Starbucks if you're waiting in line and the drink comes from the counter. someone's going to take. Do you think that any of that is reported?
No.
No. Why? It's like wife beating. Nobody wants to fess up to it, right? It's a shame. It's embarrassment. It's bad for business. And so nobody says anything. So you're hearing it amongst us here. It's the tales of wife beating, right? We don't talk about those things. And so that's how I see it. So things have to change. I have the phone numbers of a number of police commanders in the city, and I use them. And I try to do that so that people have attention. And I've also been sharing this information with council members. And I talk to them about it the same way I talk to you about it. Like, it's life-beating, guys, and nobody wants to talk about it. But, you know, it's there. But we as developers are always vastly unpopular, just in case you didn't know that. And because nobody likes change. Positive, negative, nobody likes it. And so I don't believe the topo will change, to be honest. I don't. And for affordable housing production, the city produces more affordable housing than any other jurisdiction in the United States per capita. Than any other jurisdiction. Allocates more money to it than any other jurisdiction. Please understand that, this city, right? So we have to adjust our lens a bit. If you look at the MSA, the city has more low-income people than any other part of this jurisdiction, followed closely by Prince Group. So I just want to break to that level. But it's still off topic. The question, which was, what are the challenges, right? So how many of you were practicing in 2008? Haha, okay. So, and construction prices were really high in 2008, right? Like, high. And what happened the next 2 years? Did you look something else?
Yeah, I think it dropped 20%.
20%.
Yeah, something mammoth. Right. Yeah.
So, I think we're still in 2008 for this cycle, and the prices haven't dropped. I just got back a wood frame construction price, not from that was $290,000 a unit in hard cost. And I was like, oh my God. Well, big X on that. So biggest cost items, land, interest carry, and construction, right? Those are your three top risks right there. And how that resets. There's always tools to do that. And jurisdictions, like, if I think about the 1990s for DC, when we developed our first public housing in Ward 8, a lot of people wouldn't want to go there, and nobody could get anything permitted in the city. So we were in 97. So I had a development ambassador assigned to me. It's like a chaperone at a party. He took us by the hand through all the agencies to get our stuff done. It was a broken system. And I only raise that because there are ways that the jurisdiction, whatever the jurisdiction wants to have happen, they have ways, limited in some ways, to impact that, right, and to do it. So for me, it was an ambassador in 1998. It could be stimulus that Mayor Williams put in for infrastructure construction to take away a huge barrier. Like, there are ways that people can do development that's needed. But some of these things, construction cost, interest rates, cost of land or office buildings, has to come together. So I think we're still at that point.
Yeah, I'm going to balance Vicky's comments with Lacey's, in that I agree with everything Vicky said, but I also agree with Lacey, and I'm sure Vicky does as well, that these problems are disguised as, or they're opportunities in disguise, really. I'll use my company illustratively. In 2008, the world stopped in late September, mid-September, as it were, and there was no liquidity, right? Couldn't get a loan, you couldn't get equity, debt, anything. Yet, the millennials, was it millennials at the time? Yeah, were in college and not yet having graduated, the beginning of the millennial. So you saw the second largest demographic bulge in the history of the United States in the system. Yet we couldn't build apartments in 2009 because people made subprime loans having nothing to do with rental housing, right? If you, under one model, I woke up every day and I read the Wall Street Journal and it said the world's collapsing. LIBOR was at like 5 or 6 or 7, something crazy. It had been at like 25 basis points and it was at like 6%. Think about that. And all this chaos was happening and you wanted to just cry every morning, right? But another way to do it was we went around my company. We went to each institution and we said, are you sure you don't want to lend us equity to go do these deals? Yeah, we're sure. Construction prices had come down. Millennials were loaded in the gun, ready to come out into the world. We had to find a private individual. In our case, we partnered with Penny Pritzker in Chicago, and we formed a fund because she had as much money as an institution, but was private and thus more entrepreneurial. And I only use this illustratively because I look back on it on years like this year and last year when I read the paper every day and it's miserable. And we started 11 deals, which is a lot for us, in 2 years. Not all with her. By then, the equity came back quickly, by the way. And we sold them at incredibly low cap rates, like 4% or something like that. So we made money. Everybody made money on the transactions. So I tell you all of this in a long-winded way, saying, yes, things are pretty crummy right now. Costs are crazy. Interest rates are high. Regulatory environment is terrible. But what do we know? We know that no new housing is being created, or very, very little. So if I didn't start, I think we started one deal last year. We usually do 3 to 4. And that one is generous, like we barely started, right? If that's true of my competitors and all these guys and others, you're looking at an opportunity that if you're able to find a way to start housing tomorrow, 1 month, 6 months, 8 months from now, it'll take you 2 years to build. You'll be delivering into an environment with zero, literally zero supply. Mm-hmm. So coming full circle, I agree with your previous point and maybe disagree, Bob. I actually think rents will go in and will go higher. Not, which isn't great for a resident, but because where the hell else are you going to go?
I agree with that. Bit more, it's crazy.
It's just crazy. So I think the next, bottom line, next 2 years, I think you'll see mammoth rent growth. I think rates will come in a little. Construction costs will come in a little, but not enough to save the day. I think we're saved by rents. But if you all can find a way to get in front of it, you'll be good.
Do you have a question?
I'll add one comment. Chad, I think that's an opportunity and clearly one that's contrarian. So to your point, might actually be a great idea because no one else is doing it, or very few. But I would argue you should similarly look at places like Walter Reed, where Vicky made an incredible neighborhood and environment, or City Room. You know, we manage those buildings and people want to live there because there is no crime. It's not, you don't have to guess that it might get better. It is better in theory. I'm sure there's some de minimis crime, but at least people feel a little better. My only point is there is no housing being built. I keep saying no, that's quite a grandiose statement, but very little housing being built, including suburbs. So I think the opportunity is in both places.
Yeah, I agree. I also think there's a category of housing. I agree that rents will go up. There are going to be a whole bunch of people who can't afford them, and they can't afford anything. Nothing. Which is what Bob was getting to. And so, again, that's kind of driven by government, right? People in the government are, and then yeah, they're hearing all of these complaints. I can't afford anything. I can't afford this. I can't afford that. So is there an opportunity to create workforce housing? What is that? Most times it's apartments. Like apartments, I'm sorry, I heard this a long time ago, and we always used to say apartments serve people at 85% of median income. It's kind of still the same. Right? I don't know about
this. No, I'm good. No, I agree.
Yeah. And so that's your workforce housing right there. And so I think that there are opportunities to provide work. I'd say another thing, and that is so interesting to have you here. And so what do you want for your lifestyle? Probably want good schools for your kids. Everybody in favor? Okay, good. Probably want them to be free or included. Okay. You probably want a safe neighborhood. You probably want housing that you can afford within your budgets, whatever the limitations are. You probably want a place to go and play with your kids and your family, right? Near recreation, right? You might want to do other fun things on the weekends, which would argue for the city because there's a lot of opportunity in the city. I think there's much more emphasis on recreation for your age range. And I don't know, who here spends their fun time going shopping? Okay, one. And so, like, I don't like it. So, I think you have to really look at what people want. How many of you would like to belong to a pool if you don't already? Okay. A club of some kind. A recreational facility of some kind, golf or something. I don't know, tennis, whatever. Okay. So, I think, shockingly, even poor people want that. And so we try to build our housing with those things in mind. How many of you would like to live near transit? Okay. So you can see what people want. And if you can find a way to do that as a formula, then I think that becomes a real compelling case.
I have a final question here. This second. Are there specific property types of submarkets that you can be outperform?
Like Lacey said, I think Northern Virginia for multifamily for sure, because their policies aren't screwed up.
John, can I add on to that? Sure. Fascinating to see, because I think Union Market is where everybody's built a building in the last 5 years. How has that turned out for everybody?
Us flat.
Lacey says good.
I hear that a little earlier.
You know, and with the penalty, for me, it's more like, can you sell it? Like, we built Elevation for $290,000 a unit. Think about your hard cost coming. We delivered that in 2014. Shows you how much cost it got.
But everybody jumped in, Bob. You know, once
it did, like, yeah,
10,000 units.
Yeah, just crazy. It's an amazing amount of units. So, in the Harvard Business School case that we're doing right now, you know, it's kind of fun to look at the postmortem. We're still in the middle, right? We're not done. It's amazing. All the restaurants have been added.
But I think what's most amazing is how many people went bank.
Wow.
There anyway. None. Every 10 or so years, there's an economic cycle downdraft. And I can go back and name them all. And historically, there's carnage. The brokerage business. Remember the brokerage business in 2008? A third of your friends were out of work. It was really sad because the brokerage firms were all small companies, fully capitalized, didn't have the wherewithal, and the economic impact was worse because you had banks and other institutions that were not lending. They were going out of business. They were going bankrupt. The stock market and the housing market weren't the biggest point. How many people think they're in the upper 60% of the nationwide demographic? Everybody in this room. Housing prices, the majority of those people own their real estate. The majority of people own up 40, 30% less. Stocks up. We are doing great. And I think my personal view is, as you look across your career, that's where the money is. Willie Moscone said, you got to go where the money is. We spend a lot of our time working with the lower 40% of affordable housing. I know John does the same. Tougher place to make money for a lot of reasons. But I think we are, and you, all young professionals, are so lucky because you're at a bottom after a summer. But it's not bottom without definition. We think there's good reason to think we're bottomed and everything is relatively stable. The top 60% of the economy is in really great shape where you're going to make most of your money. And they want to live in urban nodes. We grew up during a period where everybody was moving to the country or moving to the suburbs. And these cities, it wasn't just law and order. It was law and order. It was infrastructure. It was demand. There was 15 things that made it really difficult for people to build a small or a car to turn around D.C. Corrupt government. Completely in that point in time.
So today, I think I want to live in downtown DC. The population is growing despite the crime. And the same is true in suburban. People want to be near a shopping center where they can go get a cup of coffee. They don't want to live out where I grew up in West Virginia, where the coffee shop is downtown and it costs 50 cents to get a cup. So I would, again, encourage people to be optimistic, recognize noise, recognize the opportunity in the rubble, and take advantage of it.
Work.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I think multifamilies, I think offices. That's why I mean, the first question was about where opportunity is. For me, it's an office. I don't mean keeping an office. I just mean office. We're offices now. Some of it, like 11th Street, it's on 11th Street, we turn into brand new beautiful office. Others of them will be torn down and converted. That's where the opportunity is. But I also think the multifamily piece, if you're a developer, you do two things. On the buy side, I still think you can make buys at the placement cost right now. That'll be good buys in 5 years. Depends on your source, your capital. And then, you know, I do think we'll see. I'm with Toby or maybe like another, we need another 50 bips. We need the cost to come in another 8-10%. And then I think it's going to be bonkers. So if you can get something going this year, get it going this year.
Right. So most of us in this room don't have the money to buy a parcel late. If we're getting all started, to start those, what would you do? Just off the maybe the friend. What would you
do? Constant, probably.
You do what?
I would do a constant. He's, you know, micro market, you know, neighborhoods, you know, that you see upside around, you see maybe high-rise multifamily around that has been built, and you know you're putting stuff together, and preferably fields that are carry land plays where you see assemblage. But if the assemblage craps out, you still have a performing asset. And right now is not a bad time because a lot of people are hands off in their districts.
I would say find a friend, and so.
Toby has Ben Vince's phone number.
Yeah, you can't have that. I just got his phone right there with me.
I still need it.
With the exception of Toby, there are a lot of people here who are in the last third of their career, right? And your parents are too, by the way. And a lot of those people have real estate, and it's a tiring business. So I would find small scale. And I would talk to your friends, talk to your parents, the parents of your friends, figure it out, talk to your investment advisor because they handle all of those people's money, and start looking for stuff. And those people might want to partner with you but not do any of the work. They might have the asset. Like, those are things that you can do. People have made a lot of money doing that. It's very hard work. It's very hands-on if you're starting out. The other thing is find a bigger friend where you can add value to them that somebody else can't. And that value is in knowledge. And nobody here has talked about AI, but man, oh man, is that a game changer, because you can sift through so much crap to find the diamond, right? And so I would say, my grandfather used to say, the most money is made and lost in times of stress like this. Yeah. And so it's your carpe diem moment. And what you have to do is spend a little bit of time thinking and figuring it out of where you can see a value. And if you don't have any ideas, then ask somebody who does.
Well, Bob has to leave in about 5 minutes, so I'm going to let him kick off round two here. Our second round, which is two good questions for you, the audience, and his own questions. This first one, how would you navigate the challenges?
I emailed John yesterday and said, I'm a really bad candidate for this question because I hate work. I'm a big believer in being an office, frankly, not just because you're an office, but this is my personality. I grew up in a big family, more of an extrovert than not. I get energized by people and being around people. You know, my entire career, including my time in the military, was always an open day, people talking to each other. And I like the camaraderie that's created by it. I like the culture that's created by it. I like the transfer of information. I like, whether that be, a learning moment for someone or just, hey, I know that guy too. You should be looking at this. All this stuff, you miss a lot of that. You're not together. You know, you have to schedule everything. And you schedule things. Spontaneity goes away. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity missed. Do you need to be in there? listen, I'm totally cool with flexibility. If I'm going on vacation, or if I'm, let's say, not even a vacation, let's say I want to go, you know, it's July and I want to go to the beach for 2 weeks, so I'm going to be working, that's fine. You know, if you have daycare issues, you need to leave earlier, that's fine. If you don't want to come in 5 days a week, 4 days a week, okay. But you're working the other day. But I just think being together is really important. And even if, you know, all these people say, like, oh, if you're an accountant, you're doing, you know, payables, receivables, whatever, you can do that from home. Sure. But let's say you're the junior accountant. You got to schedule time to find the senior accountant to ask a question you could have leaned over and asked. So I think, look at where what street in the United States makes the most money of any street in the world, Park Avenue. What's Park Avenue doing? Everybody's working 5 days a week. Let me go real quick because I get out of here. But for me, like, you know, if you're an individual in the business, your personal capital is your credibility, right? You know, and so, which means a couple of things. Credibility means, first of all, you got to be good at what you do. And you got to be honest, and you know, and you got to be, you know, never hide shit. So for me, I'm always, you know, I put my partner and the deal first, me and my firm second. You know, you do the right thing by your partner and your firm, but by your partner and the real estate, you'll make money. And you know, and the guys have been in business a long time. You know, they're big boys. They get it. They know when shit that happens, it's not your fault, right? But shit that happens, that should be your fault. And then when that happens, you just got to own up to it real quick and say, this is what's going on. So our options are this one we're thinking of recommending, you know, and just put it out there. But I mean, being good at your job helps a lot.
I posted a story that Bob shared in an interview with him about Watergate. Not Watergate, but Boston Party. Wait, something, you know, lost his firm, and it was a tough go.
It really changed.
So, Toby, are there specific still areas of expertise that then?
Yeah, you're doing it. Bye, Boston. Yeah.
Take care. Appreciate it.
You're doing it. You're here. Others aren't. So you win this morning. And I'm only partially joking. I'll give you another example. I live in Baltimore. I drove down here this morning. And instead of listening to music that I love, I listen to a podcast about the economy. It's super boring at 6 a.m., by the way. But I know more than whoever did not do that. And I can use all the help I could get. I think showing up is something. For example, I see this group of people all the time. all the time. I mean, everywhere. So you go to an event, you go to a fundraiser, you go to the charitable thing. Lacey's very involved in charity as an example. I see him a lot. And you do these things, you show up, and then there's a connective tissue. And you're beating. Here's an idea. Go to work. Go to the office. You could just win it. I never thought I would say that, but just even going to your job during the day will put you at a distinct advantage over those that may be great, maybe better than you, but aren't there and out of sight, out of mind. And I've always described to younger people, my company, that you know how quilts have squares of different textures, et cetera, and they're all sort of sewn together. Well, think of everything you do like this morning as a square. And when you go to your office today, that's another square. And sometimes I have no idea what the hell that event was all about, or a fundraiser, boring, or something. But you were there and something may have happened. And eventually you'll look around, you'll turn around, and they'll all be together. And Mike, this gets back to your capital question. And who else is at all those events? Bankers. And you do the dinners and the lunches and the social events, and it's just staying present and top of mind. So knowledge and showing are things that you definitively can't hurt.
We are in the most connected industry that I'm aware of. I remember talking to Mark Biznow, who he was starting his business. By far, real estate was the easiest business for him to put the network together in because we all need each other. You can't build a building without an architect, a contractor, and all these other people. And the same is true on the capital side. And this is a phenomenon that should play to your advantage. Back to the 60%. The top 20% and 60% has gotten a ton richer. We're competing, you know, writing $50 million equity checks on $200 million deals with family offices. If you backward into what that means, if you're a family and you're putting $50 million into one piece of real estate, that's probably 10% of your real estate. and your real estate portfolio is probably 10% of the total. So the point is, there's a lot more big money out there, and they want folks like you who are smart, entrepreneurial, future leaders. So take advantage of the connective tissue of the quilt. It's what makes this business new, unique, and will give you the opportunity to excel if you do it well.
You've answered some of it. What advice do you give for 25-year-old starting to pick?
So, I ask everybody who comes to interview with us. So, what's your 5-year plan? Where would you like to be? Where are you going? What's your ambition? How are you going to get there? And it's shocking how many people don't have a plan. Well, I've never really thought about that. Like, what the hell, man? So first, figure out what you love, what you're good at. Usually those are the same thing. What you don't love and what you're not good at, also the same thing. And figure out where you want to be and what you want to do to get. And so that's my first piece of advice. Like, have a plan. My second part of the advice is listen to people. And the third piece is an echo of everything that's been said over here, which is relationships matter. Everybody at this table is a fiduciary of one kind or another to somebody, and you're holding trust. Serve, work with, money with you, or your government, or your community, you are a fiduciary, and you need to stand up for that. And I'm going to tell you something from my past. I've been through a number of recessions since I grew up in real estate. In the one that happened in 89 and 90, my partner today, Lois, said, hey, wouldn't you like to come and work for a bad bank? I was like, what? And I didn't even know what it was. I was pretty young. And I went to work for a place called South Charlesville before closing on developers. My family had been in development for generations. And so at the age of 25, I started doing that. 26. And it was brutal, like brutal. And there were people who looked like us who wouldn't answer a phone call. I was representing the bank and they wouldn't. It's like a game of hide and seek. And then there were people who stepped to the plate and they're like, yep, I got a problem here and I'd love to work it out with you. And what would you like me to do? And how are we going to work this out together? And there was a significant difference in how those people performed over time. Horrible story, right? But it matters what you do when the game gets tough. Yeah. And we've been through good times together and bad times together. And how people act during those periods of time matters tremendously. So I want you all to think about that for your careers as well. Like how you handle those relationships. Well, that's people talk to me. A lot of people that we talk about their entrepreneurial aspirations. Most honest ones will say, I would like to learn as much as I possibly can from you and go out on my own and build my wealth and business. Check. I'm down for that. You know, a more suave approach that I've seen is, oh, well, I'd love to learn from you and then be a part of your team forever. But
We know that.
But people also, like, I'm going to answer like the worst thing I've ever heard. Oh, I like to vision project. Like, what the hell, man? Really? And junior, whatever. And it's that's not a good answer. And so, for me, I think people who talk about being part of a team, talk about relationships, and talk about where they actually want to go and have. I don't know. You ask this question.
No, that's we do to some degree, and I sense your skepticism, meaning it's well placed, and that it's okay if some of the people that work for us want to move on. We had a young guy, Martin Ditto, some of you know Martin, mm-hmm. and he was a good developer, and I could just tell that he was itching and raring to go. And instead of arguing with him about it, he just said, "I think that's great, and good luck, and call us." I remember there's an old J&G model that I regrettably didn't follow, which is invest in those people leaving your company.
Yes.
And I made a mistake there that Mark and Alessia did in a positive way, went out and raised money for friends and family. I should have been right. I don't know why. We don't typically invest in others, so it had nothing to do with Mark at all, but that was a mistake. And it's encouraging to watch someone succeed that worked under your learn something positive, because then it's this sort of wonderful ripple effect on the community. Things. And he did some new projects, and I'm sure he will continue.
So, Henry, I'm going to ask you, how would you recommend building a professional network?
Well, when I look back at my career, I was at Charles E. Smith for 17 years in the Rappaport. And you know, not everybody likes to go to the events that we all go to. We were talking about charitable events. And I consider us all to be friends because we've done things at Children's Hospital or whatever together. And we run into each other, and we, I think we have a mutual admiration, respect. Mr. Smith had just given a lot of money to the Children's Hospital for some research foundation. Basically, because I was the guy who was willing to go to these events. He called me into his office and said, "I want you to be on the foundation for Children's Hospital." At the time, I think I was maybe 37 years old. And the youngest person on that board other than me was probably 60, you know. And I was like, "Really?" She said, "Yeah, I want you to represent, you know, the company, the family." So once I got there, I was like, "Well, I got to do something. I can't just go to the meetings." And I became the co-chair of Children's Hospital Ball, which is now super, one of the most successful events in town. At the time, it was not. It was called Jazzmatazz. But I saw an opportunity. So, you know what? I think I can fix this. And even though everybody else on that foundation, I was kind of surprised nobody else on the foundation board kind of stepped up. It was, you know, had given millions of dollars themselves. And so, you know,
hard work.
Your energy is such that, oh yeah, he's the guy.
Well, thank you, John. But take risks. You know, I mean, I will tell you, I sat there and I'm like, I'm going to, you know, go over and I won't pick the names, but Apertz's and you know, all these other people that were, you know, household names in D.C. And take those chances. The one thing I want to add to that, one time I was walking with Mr. Smith, who had made billions of dollars in Crystal City and developing in Washington, D.C. And he was a very, very smart guy and really trusted people, but you didn't say dumb things in front of him. Because, I mean, he was just like, "What?" You know, it was, and again, I was one of the younger executives at Charles E. Smith, which at the time was the biggest residential and office developer in Washington, D.C. And he had made billions of dollars specifically for Crystal City. And for those of you not been there, well, probably haven't been there because at the time, Crystal City used to have a road that went around. It was a loop. And all the buildings are called Crystal something. Place, plaza, gateway. So if you're coming to visit and you make a wrong turn, you are screwed. Can I think about that?
Before GPS.
Yeah, before GPS. Thank you. Thank you for that. But most of it was, you know, Department of Defense, Patent Trademark Office, so a lot of people that came there all the time. We were trying to transition to being a true office destination for private office as well. And I went into a meeting and said, we need to, you know, two-way all the streets to make into a grid system. It sounds just like now. And I almost stood up. Because they had made so much money on that system. But a couple weeks later, Mr. Smith called me up and said, "You know what? I think you're right." We changed the grid system. We tore down some buildings at retail on the street, which everybody's read, underground's finally closing after 15 years. And so my big takeaway is go out, make those connections, keep all those. I'm still a card guy. I'll give you a card today. You know, make sure people remember you. You know, get that card. Don't just email. Well, email is great. Email, but if you give me your card's going to be on my desk. I don't throw them away. I'm going to see it. Go, yeah, you know, we met a while back. You know, all these little things that nobody else is doing. I can't tell you how many people in your demographic, they're like, I don't care. Like it's below, you know. And I can't tell you how many people I look at later and go, yeah, I can help that person. So he said, yeah. I use Audible. I don't listen to music either. I don't listen to news because it just pisses me off. Both sides. Yeah. And so right now I'm listening to Audible 10 times is easier than 2 times. Pretty cool. Yeah. So it's pretty cool. We have 4 hours. And go to the next. Once you start doing Audible books like that that are helpful, Audible will start suggesting more of those types of books to you. So you don't have to go out and find them. They're kind of given to you. But in conclusion, take a risk like I'm talking about. You know, put the time in. Think about how to do things differently. You know, go to somebody and say, you know, I've been thinking about this. I think we could do this project differently. What do you lose? Last thing is if you're saying no to somebody, do it with a smile. Most people feel like they have to be all serious and you know, change their composure to say no. Look at Vicky. Look at Toby. Now, when I said it, he smiled. You know, do it pleasantly. People, you're going to do business. The people I'm doing business with, you know, people that I felt did not like me when I left Charles E. Smith. This is an interesting story. When I went to, I've now been a rep for 20 years. The people, when I left, I felt were not my buddies. They're the people who called me up and gave me business. You know, you don't know who's going to be your best mentor or source of business in the future. So this is back to my conclusion on John's podcast. Love everybody. It's easy. Smile's free. You know, and I think it, when you smile, it gives you personal enjoyment too.
Final question, please. What role does technology?
Well, I'll sort of stay on the entrepreneurial bent. I think I look at the world as opportunities and barriers to entry. So I think that in real estate for a long time, information flow was a barrier to entry because if you wanted to learn buy property in Phoenix and you were in Washington, you had to figure out who the brokers were, call them up on the phone, get them to send you a book that took multiple weeks to for them to generate for you to process. We all have so much information at our fingertips. There are endless opportunities and you all are in your career on the front end of AI, which I really think of more as data analytics. We're in a hugely data-driven business, but the information is imperfect and dispersed. So I'm encouraging, you know, my teenage kids to really focus on data analytics. I think it relates to real estate. There are all sorts of inefficiencies that if you work hard, you can uncover, and there are more efficiencies to be created. We're working hard to automate our underwriting. So our analysts in Excel are really becoming data analytics analysts and processing information, not just on the individual property, but on all the comps and everything else much more quickly and much more efficiently. I think we're much better able to analyze trends in markets. Our sector, multifamily, is driven largely by demographics. And if you can really understand where people are moving, not just city to city, but neighborhood by neighborhood, that can really help improve your performance. So we're dedicated to that. And again, the barriers to entry that are so low for you. You don't need to go build a system. Remember when Avalon Bay built the first revenue management system in the whole apartment industry? They spent like tens of millions of dollars on it in 5 or 7 or 10 years. And it made a difference for them for about 2 years until all the programmers who did it went and started their own company and then sold it and it became the systems that we all use today. And so you have access to an incredible amount of technology that can help you find inefficiencies in the market and capitalize on them. And so to me, those are the really some of the most important aspects. Related is prop tech. Everybody's familiar with all the new products that are being generated to do all sorts of things that were relatively mundane processes, like our guys that go fix things at apartment buildings. You know, we never really thought, gee, there's a lot of inefficiency there. We knew it wasn't really well done. It was tough to kind of count the numbers. Now all that data is available to us instantaneously. On our handhelds, we can look at rents into the future and tell leasing agents what the rent should be. So they no longer have to spend, you know, 5-7 hours a month sitting down with 7 or 8 people trying to figure these things out. So continue to look for places where prop tech or AI or data analytics are going to create opportunities, and find a partner if you're not a data person who can figure that out. And together with you raising the money and them figuring out the opportunities, and maybe a third person who's out buying and managing the properties, you create a team that over the next 10 or 20 years is going to do, I'm sure, incredibly well. So those are some of my thoughts on technology, and I know nothing about technology. Yeah, exactly. Because people of our generation tend not to.
We've got about 10 minutes for Q&A, so go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think there are a couple of factors. One is the scale of the players. If you were Oliver Carr, who built a lot of these buildings in the 70s and 80s and did a great job of turning the city around, he only played in D.C. And there were a handful of banks that were all regional banks that lent to the D.C. developers. If you blew up that relationship, you blew up your business. Today, we invest in 17 or 18 states, and we invest with largely a handful of very large institutions that won't go out of business if we hand back a loan to them. So the dynamics are quite different. And I think that that's part of it. I think the other interesting thing, and this is an opportunity for your generation. We have largely been a country that's where lending has come from federally regulated institutions. But as we've all read, private credit is on the rise. And we've seen private credit in other forms in the past. That's part of what blew up the economy in 2006, 2007. And it's going to move heavily into real estate. Those relationships are completely trading relationships. You know, you tell a guy that you're going to default on your CMBS loan. He doesn't care, you know, and you don't know him. He doesn't know you. The workout people, they don't care. So that we're moving more and more in that direction. That sector's getting a bigger and bigger volume of real estate. So I think it'll create an even less personalized dynamic. I personally think it also creates a lot of risk because those people are not regulated. We're in the private equity. We're in there partly because we don't want to be regulated. We are an SEC registered company, but we're not regulated like a bank, and I'm on a bank. You can't believe how much regulation banks are under. But we've seen it before. You put traders in a business with a lot of money, and they're lending to the liquid sector like real estate, probably going to be a train wreck somewhere in the next 5 to 15 years. So keep your eye out for that because it could create more opportunity.
Let me jump on what Lacey's saying. You know, the CMBS special servicers, not only do you not have a relationship with them, they are incentivized to screw everybody.
Yes. Totally.
It's the craziest thing. So bankers like, well, I'm going to do another loan with them and hey, I'll help you. I'll do this and that. They won't even, special servicers won't even talk to you until you are in the fall. You call them up 3 months ahead and say, hey, I got a problem. This lease is, excuse me, this loan is coming due. You know, can we work out an extension? They won't even talk. So they put you in on your heels from the very beginning.
And their fee quadruples or more when you go into special servicing. And so they want to get you in and they want to get you out.
And they want to keep churning their fee as long as they can.
Yeah.
No, they do actually. Yeah. Well, yeah, no, if they can extort you for an extra 5%, they'll give you an extension. But if you can't play that game because the property's already, you know, X amount under, you take it, and then they churn it. CW Capital was great last time around. We did a lot of business with them. But I think the CMBS special servicing industry changed since 2007, 2008, didn't it? Now, you got the different piece of owners of the bonds, and there's one guy that has the highest interest rate, right? He's the guy who's going to do anything he can to make his group make money, counter to the other bondholders. Can I explain this correctly?
I think to your point, servicers don't want you to turn the keys over because they have no clue what to do. Banks at least know what a workout looks like and how to do it. And so what I think that leads to, we certainly saw it in 2009, 10, 11, 12, is assets that are in trouble just tend to sit. And they suffer because there's no one's pumping any money into them if it's an apartment to fix the heater or to do this or do that. So another opportunity, I think, over the next 5 years, particularly in older apartments and maybe office buildings, is a lot of these buildings are going to sit and start to rot because nobody can get the keys and fix it. So if you're patient, you can pick up these rotted buildings, renovate them, reposition them, and make a lot of money. That's going to happen some point in the next 5 to 10 years.
Other questions? Go ahead, Aaron. Hey, Aaron, go ahead. Aaron used to work with CW Capital.
Well, I think if I could, on behalf of the panel, I'd like to just further acknowledge John's role. John has essentially taken a nickel and turned it into a dollar through this program. And one of the things that's important is to keep in mind is everyone's career moves at a different pace. I've had a lot of friends who were enormously successful right out of college. I'm out trying businesses and failing and thinking that that's going to be the rest of your life. But many of those folks, the second half of their life didn't work as in the second half of our careers worked well. John has had multiple careers, but I think that it's really fantastic that part of this overall fabric or quote concept, he's filled a void that I don't think anyone had ever addressed, which is the history of real estate and the relationships and what we can learn from one another. And I think that's a tremendous, important part of any family or any community, the history, the fabric. And I think that, when it's all said and done, John, your legacy is the quilt maker is going to be well respected and long remembered.
Well, in 2019, we looked around the universe. Here we are in the podcast realm. And I said, the stories I'm hearing on all these podcasts. And I said to myself, I know a lot of people in Washington, including all these people here, and a lot of others. I said, I'm just going to start doing this. I called up Gary Rappaport. Gary is like I am. Knows everybody. He gives constant love.
He's the hardest worker in D.C. still?
Yeah. Gary Rappaport is 7. He works 7 days a week. He's in the office.
Loves it, breathes it.
I almost cried. Anyway, he was my inspiration to some extent. He encouraged me. Yeah, I loved it. So I just went up about 5 or 6 other people. I started calling. Sure. Let's talk. Let's do it. And it evolved. And now we're at 123. And this is the next one. Today. But thank you all for being here. A couple comments I want to make. For the QR code here and here, you would snap that. I've prepared a survey. Really would appreciate it. Not only for today, but also for the future going forward. We've been in existence 3 years now. As Kevin has said, we toured examples, I would say, Ray Ritchie of lots of properties took us to Justin Johnson and spent a whole afternoon walking around and said, gave us a full, reception. Just for my group. And then
then he separately took us to 2100 and then took us to one of the local pubs right there. Just an example of what ICON is giving back. So the program is to do it once, 1 month, one tour a month, one Ask Me Anything event. And I have a curriculum, so all of you signed on, remember, take a look at the platform. I have a program built on the 17th, which is a week from Friday, and I have an orientation for new members, people that haven't been involved in the community. Noon, online, so you'll see as you can look at this replay. This, as I said, is a podcast, so you'll be able to watch this again. I'm going to share the video of this with you. I'm not going to go live broadly with the video, but audio here. So, are there any questions or any other comments anybody wants?
I would love that. This has been burning in my soul since I read it yesterday. I would love for the panel and please, everybody in the audience, to talk about the BXP deal in Metro Center. What do you think about them tearing that building down? I get that because it's, but making that move right now to build a trophy building there. You know, Folger Pratt, anybody here from Folger Pratt? They built a building, Tyson's Corner, to be a trophy building because there was no new trophy right by the Metro, not Spring Hill Metro, but the next one. I'm not sure. Tyson something. Greensboro, thank you.
Bless you.
And to my knowledge, it's just sitting there. It's a see-through building. Now, in the article yesterday, they talked about having a free lease of 5 to 6 floors. Anybody know the tenant?
It was a locker.
Yeah. I mean, even so, let's call it 50% leased. Doesn't that seem like a huge debt?
Well, I looked at 2110.
Completely redone.
What a problem. We took several of us here.
Yeah.
They put some of the TIs for the former Hale in that building. $800 a foot. You know, just incredible. $1,000. But the rents are over triple digits. They're paying on over $100. So the top tenants are able to pay
government repairs.
Yeah, well, it's the whole offer.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd say this. I actually think it's great. And if it was up to me, I'd take the line that is Independence Avenue and 395, and I tear it all down between there. Those buildings are high vintage. And they're done, and some people really like them because they like that architecture. I don't think they're functional. I think they're functional. I think it's a place where people can be. I was on this little government commission about tearing down these offices and or repurposing them, and a gentleman took me aside and he said, "Do you know the history of office buildings?" "No, I don't." And he said, "Well, office buildings really came to be after the Second World War when we started having big government enterprises. We had to push a lot of paper. And so this was a place where people came, mostly men, came to work and push paper as part of communications. And we now have computers. We've had them for quite some time. And so the whole concept of how it was set up, with these big bullpens of this and that, he's like, the functionality has changed entirely, which I thought was really kind of interesting, right? And then we went through this swing of how small can we make the space for each individual? And then we've gone through this swing of hotel and office space. And I think that the federal government office space thing, you can put a fork in it. It's done. And it's been done for a long time because they've already contracted out in the last year. And so cost of maintaining those buildings per employee is like $100,000 a year. Shoot me now. Like, that's crazy. That's nuts. Like, that's a bad business proposition, even if it is government. And so I think that gives us a tremendous amount of opportunity to revision this for the city. NCPC is going to cry. And that's just the bottom line, because a lot of those buildings are now historic. And so there's got to be some kind of an overarching way and a plan to do it. But I think that the office building scenario has changed. And that new building is probably going to be
I see a little.
I think it's going to be functionally very different. But I don't, I'm not a maybe you guys have a good
We have a small portion of our portfolio is in the office. And a couple things we've seen. One is, again, the top 20%, they're doing great. There's a lot of money out there, and they have not really felt the recessions. Why they shouldn't be able to pay more rent now than they could pay 10 years ago seems an easy question. Seems like they could easily do it. And we're seeing in every market that we're in, the class of AA space is fully leased. Look at Hudson Yards, numerous examples in Dallas. So BXP is really small. I mean, it makes sense for somebody to say, yeah, I'm going to be the very best building in D.C. It's a big market. It's one of the biggest in the country. There's got to be 400,000 square feet of demand. I think that Monty filled his office pretty well with the war. So it's great that they're doing it. I think it's one more example of the fact that we're on the bottom, the upswing of this recession cycle.
Anybody?
It's coming. I've talked to somebody who's in Doge. Entity, yes. And I've been told, this is a pretty senior person there, that there could be demolition of buildings like that.
I think we, there's a Wall Street Journal article about 18 months ago, we were luckily featured that in Philadelphia. We renovated 3 office buildings, residential, in the last 10 years. It was primarily about Wall Street. And in 1990, Wall Street population within that submarket was like 30,000. And there was a huge exodus of office from there up to Midtown and other parts of the market. So the city got behind tax incentives to redevelop those office buildings. And those office buildings are largely built before air conditioning. That makes the floor plan very adaptable. And that's the same thing we found in Philly. So it's in part what the story is about. But the main part of the article is that it takes a long time. And you've got to have the right sorts of buildings. And we've looked at a bunch of these deals. Generally, you've got to get the basis to $100 a foot or less. And that's really hard to do. And it's really hard to do in D.C. because you've got not narrow buildings. Work, you need about 70 feet of depth for part of the building modification. You've got this big square footprint, but even if it's a lot, it doesn't work really well for building an office building. So I think it's going to be a long, slow recycling process. And I don't think anybody's going to tear down a building unless they're ready to build it. So I think one of the challenges the city's going to have is, what do you do with these ghost buildings? There used to be a bunch of them in New York when I lived there, and that's usually where guys, thieves hung out in the dark crevices of the entrances when you walk by. So, and I think we've all seen, it's going to be a huge dent in the city's revenue bucket. So we'll see how they adapt to that.
I agree. Although they don't have much revenue, they will have an option to sell the population.
But that's
that the government
owns. Sure, sure.
I agree with you. Government is works at a snail's pace.
But it's the market. The free market can't. You gave me a 400 by 400 lot in downtown D.C. I'm not sure what I'd do with it.
Right. And so they're, JLL is working on it. They've pulled together a bunch of different working groups of people. And they are looking at what buildings to target first, what to do about it, trying to figure out the whole plan, and what the value is. And I think the consensus was that they might have overvalued their portfolio and it might be worth this. And so those are things that are being discussed. And you know, our new president is a real estate developer, and I think our mayor went to see him about creating a world-class city and making an opportunity, and I think that took a hell of a lot of guts. and smarts to go and do that. And who knows how it'll work out, but I think there's a pretty solid bet for it. And my expectation is that they will pick the low-hanging fruit first.
Again, it's worth noting that DC's office occupancy rates are lowest in the nation, and the U.S. is way behind here. So I personally think we're at the bottom there, and it can trend better, and I think the federal government's going to get a little heavier handed in pushing people to do it. That apparently is going to lead to a lot of early retirements and a lot of government employees. But I don't think those jobs will get filled. Hopefully they get filled by young people who are going to live in apartments downtown, and it'll create even more.
I don't think they'll get filled. I think they'll get contracted out. All of them.
But the contractor has to hire a person.
That's right.
And that person's going to need an apartment.
Yeah.
Right, but they're going to be in D.C. somewhere. That federal building hopefully will get sold and maybe leased to the private sector.
I agree. And I think that's largely right. Like, I walked through the HUD building. I was going to a meeting with the commissioner. And she took me aside and she's like, oh, yeah, 40% of our people are retirement eligible. And if the administration changes before the election, I think they're all going to retire. They're not coming back to work. They're just not doing that. And so this is what it is. And maybe that's okay. Maybe it's okay. And maybe it's time for a new day and better processes.
Well, it's interesting talking about HUD and the housing industry. Fannie and Freddie may turn private.
It's a pendulum, right?
Yeah.
One way, the other.
Mm-hmm. So, what does that mean? Capital markets. Any other questions? Go ahead.
You know, we were back solving for sort of $500-$600 a foot. So that's it depends on the market, but presumably the land gets crammed down to whatever value makes the numbers work. Renovation. Even with new construction. I think the challenge with renovations are there are always more surprises than the contingency anticipates. And so that is harder to finance and so on and so forth.
I think the construction costs for an office building conversion and new construction are converging. They're very close. So it puts it on the borderline. Do you tear it down or do you keep it? I have two office building conversions. There are two buildings next to each other. And it's a unique location with a unique requirement with a unique program and not replicable by tearing it down. Because we certainly looked at it and it doesn't work. They're very kind of residential looking things. And we did two down at the Southwest waterfront. They're Lex and Leo, and we sold them to Bernstein. It's very hard to find a contractor who's comfortable doing that. Our contractor made money, but let me tell you, those buildings were built in the 70s. They were one of the first close tension buildings ever built. And so it's a belts and suspenders building, which allowed us to do some things that we actually can shift 2,000 poles in each building for plumbing and other things that need to go from floor to floor. And we have somebody who was willing to do that and could do that because ground penetrating radar was not as good a tool back then. And if you had to shush the toilet a little this way and shush the shower a little that way, we had enough room inside the footprint. But it was really something, and they turned out to be really beautiful and successful. But you really have to find the right contractor to do that. And it's not that easy, right?
And not surprisingly, BXP is not doing that.
Right.
That's the opportunity for the small entrepreneurial local strip shooter. And if you want to be in business on your own, you got to find those opportunities and then get really good at them. And when you do, suddenly growth occurs.
One more question.
Mm-hmm. Nobody just said to me I should start on this, but you want to start?
Yeah, we've got a piece, 75 unit piece of land, zone 14 housing over at Skyland. east of the river. And, you know, with all things we set for interest rates, construction costs, it would be podium. Whether we stick built on top of podium, that's not going to work. So unless you know, district or somebody comes forward with some grant, can build it.
Yeah, we own a fair bit of affordable seniors town, and that's super well. It's always full. People, nice thing about seniors is once they're in, they stay for a long-ish time. We've also got a little bit of assisted living. It's affordable at both the feet. And that certainly is interesting for people who are indigent. That never happened before. I guess a couple of them in D.C., but not in many of them. So that's one thing. And we have market-rate senior underdevelopment. Look to the Zudo to imagine the slow. I keep asking these hypothetical questions like, you guys are kind of too young to have put your parents in a senior's house, right? But I've done it. Yep. And my parents are too busy, so I can see whatever I want to see. But it was probably a 6-month process looking for it. And my mom came out of an 8. My dad was a builder. We had 8 bedrooms, 8 bathrooms. And she just lived there all by herself in Potomac. She, you know, it was just a lot. She was still working at paper. And so we found her a spot, and then she insisted that it had to be fully renovated. And so we did that and moved her into it. And I think there's a typical process of leasing these that's really interesting. A lot of them are co-ops, some of them are condos, some of them, you know, and there's the whole selling the home business that gets into it. So it's a major life thing. I think. Most seniors have lived in their housing for a very long time, and most of them are not renters. They're homeowners. 65% are homeowners, and they've paid off their mortgages. Or they paid them to a point where they pay, you know, I always joke, and I do this with local jurisdictions when I'm talking, what's the most affordable housing you have in your jurisdiction? And it's my mother's house with 8 bedrooms in it, where she's paying $1,000 a month to live there. That's your most affordable housing, and it's prevalent, right? And so there's a gap in imagination for seniors, and they're like, hey, man, I'm going to move into an apartment that's a third of the size of my house, and I'm going to pay 3 times as much? Is that right? And it's so I think it's a resistance to moving. And so I've been thinking about how do you do that during lease up? Do you offer 6 months free rent for a 2-year lease. Mm. Like, do you do that and say, move on in and do it yourself? We'll spread it over time. Like, how do you incent somebody? Because lease-up paces are 1/3 of the market rate. So that's your conundrum. But you got to think about what you can do to incent that person to make that deal.
But to Chad's question, you think the demand would outstrip that supply that you would like be a rush to move in. And just,
I think you're right, Henry, but you're right. But the person with no mortgage has to sell their house to somebody that's going to put a mortgage on it. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to get a mortgage for an 8-bedroom house at 7%. So there are a lot of, unscientific comment, forgive me, but there are a lot of people stuck.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, I like Vicky's new building. I would love to move there. Or maybe I could even see myself there. But I have to wait. So I think the economy has to break, get a little better. But nonetheless, I think the macro theme, Chad, is focus on demographics, right? The largest two groups are baby boom and millennials. I already talked about millennials. The baby boom is now aging into housing of some sort, or should, or will. And not everybody wants to live in civil living. They don't want to feel old. So some might rent. So I bet you could come up with a product type that was some variant you poked around. I kind of like the business, but it's really slow, to your point. So I kind of don't.
But once it's full, it's full.
Once it's full, nobody leaves.
Well, they do.
Well, they leave, but not
on the horizontal.
To me, also, creating experiences.
Yeah.
If you create experience, I mean, I'm 7, so I'm 5 to 10 years away from moving out. Maybe you listen. So where am I going to go? I'm going to go find a place that has experiences, opportunity for me, close to my children.
Walkability.
Right. So, John, we did the Ritz-Carlton condos in Pepper Chase, the classic, not meant to be lately a place for older people, but it marketed it accordingly. And those that live in the building, including my parents, by the way, have the ability to have social. They have cocktail parties. Mm-hmm. And they bring speakers in, and they, candidly, the people in the building are so interesting in their own right. The cocktail party along with your neighbors is cool. And so they're engaged without feeling like they're living in a place for older people.
Where that stuff costs money.
Yeah,
and
that's the.
You also start down the acuity. Yeah. So, are you? Do you have a doctor who comes once a week and does checkups? So, we've looked at it a number of times. Beware of the stuff. Beware of the cost creep. And if you find a way to make old people make decisions on lifestyle, call me because I got two sets of parents, and it's been 10 years. In the process of getting them to move out. But that's part of it. Slowly
steps. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh,
I really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Ron Gardner.
Thank you, Ron.
Yes. No worries.
Thank you, Ron.
Great to see you.